after the physics, we have a strong two-point correlation because Paris first. Because we love Paris. And every now and then we see one another in Paris and say, I heard.
That's exactly right. In fact, 2 years running, I can tell you the cafe too,
yeah,
while I was walking from.
With my wife, and there he was. So it's a pleasure to have him here. QCT, he's an expert.
Let me tell you about some work that is the outgrowth of some years, a decade's worth of trying to do a billion icicle physics, and doing it for non-abelian processes. We thought we had this problem completely lit about a couple of years ago, or a year ago, let's say. We had found out how to do things for non-abelian situations. And then just about a few months ago, we found that that it was much simpler and much better and much cleaner and much neater, the solutions we got. And the solutions we have, we now call them virtual gluon ghost solutions. And what's happened is that, well, you'll see what's happened as I go through it. HMF is me, Yves Gabellini and Thierry Grandoux are professors at Nice, and Ming-Y.M. Xu, Ming for short, is my ex-graduate student. He just got his degree at Brown. And he's Taiwanese, and we call ourselves the Echo 4. So it has a certain amount of humor to it. Anyway, if you can read this, it says it's a new approach to QCD, and what it is a blending of previous field strength attempts to do non-perturbated QCD with the Eichel models, which some of us, I mentioned Jean Levan from Paris, myself, and Yves Gabellini from Nice, which we learned how to make Eichel models in non-abelian theories. Let me just give you the history. The history is really the most important part, because I can show you what we're doing, and once you see it, it's clear. But the pain, and the not the agony, but the thought process that went into this are sort of interesting. I'll define Eichel in a moment, or you can read that. But an Eichel approximation is one for abelian theories, which allows you to sum non-perturbatively over many infinite number of quark exchanges. The quarks that you're exchanging are the quanta of scalar or neutral. They're neutral. It could be scalar, vector, meson fields, and the Eichel models that we've always had for abelian physics in the past work beautifully. They are non-perturbative. Then what they give you is essentially coherent scattering. You have, say, two particles coming through which exchange an infinite number of neutral vector mesons, for example, and you can get very good representations of the scattering of that situation by using an Eichel model. The point is you get coherent scattering because there's nothing that prevents the scattering from being. You get coherent exchanges. There's nothing that prevents the exchanges from being coherent. When you go to non-abelian theories, immediately there's a combinatoric program, because if a proton emits a pi plus or a positive quanta, it's no longer a proton, and you've got to take those things into account. And that was always a royal pain, and we figured out how to do this, 8, 9 years ago or something like that, the people who listed there. Why study Eichel models? Because first I have to give you the definition. You have particles, think of them as fermions, for example, which are going to scatter or do something. And if they have a certain amount of typical momentum, which is called T, the quanta they will be emitting will have momenta called K. And if the P's are larger than the K's, there's a very simple approximation called the Eichel approximation, which allows you to write down the Green's function for that in closed form. And it has a very simple form, and I'll show you as we go along. And I say down here, for 30 years, there has existed, you understand my grammar, that's there existed, thank you, there existed a strong coupling of abelian physics. I mean, people were always talking, how do you make strong coupling particle physics? We all know about perturbation theory, but what do you do for strong coupling? Well, for 30 years, there's existed the strong coupling of Abelian physics, the zeroth approximation is the icon. And you can certainly define corrections to it in a systematic manner. The agreement we got from experiment starting in 30, even 40 years ago is just extraordinary. In the days before we had to worry about the quark structure of protons, we were able to model all sorts of reactions. And I listed a couple of them down there. The accuracy with which you can reproduce the experimental data is just striking.
Sorry, in strong coupling expansion, is that we normalize coupling or bare coupling?
It's average coupling. I mean, you know, if you're going to do the yes, it's a very relevant question. When you there are certain places from which you get renormalization effects, and in the Eichel model, what you do typically to make life easy for yourselves is to assume that you're dealing with renormalized mass and renormalized charges. You can put that in if you wish, and that's a whole separate sort of calculation, and it will work, and you'll get reasonable answers. But that's a different add-on. So when I talk about a coupling constant G or a mass M, let it be renormalized. And the discussion about how to get there is separate, but you can do it. There's no question you can do it. You can do it perturbatively, you can do it non-perturbatively, I can give you references. Now what do we do with this one, please? Oh my God. Move this out of the way. Now, so that's what I want to talk about. And I want to talk about it I want to talk about it in the context of QCD. I'll start just by, how do you do these things for QCD? How do you begin a theory? For QCD, how do you begin it for QED? The main approach to QCD is the standard one where you write down the generating functional in terms of, I'll use the hockey stick, in terms of an integral over A, this tells you what gauge you're using, this keeps the whole thing invariant when you go from gauge to gauge, and I've already done the functional integrals over the fermion coordinates, and that's what they produce, and you have, as far as this is a source for the gluons, and this is the F squared. This is all standard stuff. The G of A is a potential theory Green's function for a quark. I'm talking about quarks now. For a quark moving in a fictitious field A with color index A and Lorentz index mu, it satisfies this differential equation. So we all know what we're talking about. Potential theory differential equation, and that's a Gell-Mann matrix lambda. Okay? This quantity L of A is the log of the fermion determinant of that problem. SC is just the fermion propagator when there's no field, when A is equal to zero, just the bare quark propagator. And what this means in terms of graphs, you have a single quark loop and an infinite number of A's popping out of it all over. That's what the L means in terms of graphs. The normalization factor is chosen such that the Z of 0 when all the sources equal to 0 is equal to 1. The gauge invariance in this stuff is very clear. It's the reason why it was written down in the first place. I use the phrase MGI for manifestly gauge invariant and MCI for manifestly. MLC for manifestly Lorentz covariant, when you see those expressions on the blackboard. I'll compare this later with the result using in field strength, the 93 result of Reinhardt and colleagues in some instanton approximation, but who essentially do the non-perturbative problem, but in a completely different context. And we were so happy a month or two ago when we realized that we agreed with the non-perturbative form that they found in 93. They're using it for something completely different, and we are using it to actually talk about scattering of particles. And what we do is, I think, is different from what they do, and our result is slightly different from what they do. What we're going to find is manifest gauge invariance. You couldn't make a gauge choice if you wanted at the very end, in the middle of this calculation. They can always pick a gauge. Us, there's no question you can't pick a gauge because it's manifestly gauge invariant. That's one of the interesting things. It still gives me a shiver down my spine when I look and see what happens with this. Anyway, I'm going to, that's the most well-known of, way of setting up.
So, you tell me you put in a gauge fixing terminal Lagrange and what happened?
No. I didn't say that. I'll show you what I'm going to do for me. This is the standard way of doing it, all right?
You say you can't pick a gauge.
Forget my remark. I'll make it clear in a minute.
And
you'll see what I'll do. I'm going to effectively make it such, we're going to get manifest gauge invariant formulation of QCD almost at the beginning. But we won't use this formulation, we'll use a Schwinger formulation. There's a difference. You prescribe certain things differently, you take different actions. But I can't describe it until, don't make me describe it until I get there, okay?
Is it going to turn into essentially a background gauge covariant?
Wait. It's different. And when you see this happen, you suddenly realize people, I don't want to say all people, but we certainly have missed this for years.
I have another question. Those emissions that your L corresponds to, do those have...
No, they're not emissions. They're just a picture. A pictorial way of saying what this is. It's like a single quark loop with an arbitrary number of A factors sticking on the quark loop.
There's
not emissions.
There's no momentum restriction like your coinal.
Like who?
Your coinal restriction, you say, in the K. That momentum is not in this L function? Or is it?
No.
That's just
the eigen approximation later will be very simple in QED, and I'll do it here temporarily. And QCD is just to throw away the L's. And the eigen approximation will be in the G's. You'll see that.
You have a usually not being in ghost fields.
You can add those in if you want to keep ghost fields, but the ghosts I'm talking about are completely different ghosts. Not Fadia Popov ghosts.
Not Fadia.
No. You can put those in if you want, but that's a
ghost.
Yeah. You want to do that, you can do that. I don't care about that.
Since the L's are going to be important, so far this is an exact statement, and I could have thought it was being traced a lot of the problem.
Yeah, that's right.
That's exactly.
Okay. Pick a gauge. Oh, okay. We're going to do it differently. We're going to pick our gauge differently in the Schwinger formulation. I'm going to use the action principle. I hope you guys know what Schwinger action principle is. I'll remind you in a minute. I just want to comment before doing anything else that this F squared I can write in terms of subtract off little f. Here's little f and here's big f. It's obvious what I'm doing. I'll call the difference of these two things L prime, and I've written L prime over here. And L prime is the baby that contains all the cubic and quartic gluon interactions. Okay? So when you're talking QCD, you have not just the ordinary interactions, but you have cubic and quartic gluon interactions here. Okay. Now, what do you do in QED? There's no L prime, there's no color indices, the two Fs are the same. How do you do proper quantization in QED? Usually, when you do it in the Coulomb gauge, it's not manifestly Lorentz covariant because you have to pick out which of your dynamical variables, which are the variables that satisfy equations of constraint. To obtain QED in a manifestly Lorentz covariant form, you can do one of two, you can do one of several ways. The original way, though I heard Schwinger lecture, it took about 6 hours of lecture to do this, you can adjoin operator gauge transformations to everything, to all the Green's functions you find in the Coulomb gauge, and with those operator gauge transformations, you change those Green's functions into the ordinary Feynman gauge, anybody relativistic gauge Green's functions. Or you can do essentially the same thing by a little functional trick, which I'm going to do. What you can do is you can take this exact statement of F squared. We all know this is a statement from F squared. And what you do is you just multiply this embarrassing term, this awkward term, by a lambda. If you were Fermi in the old days, you would have said, throw it away. And that's what he did. But put a lambda on it and treat this term as an interaction term, as an effective G equals zero interaction term. And then what you can do is pretend you're doing a Schwingerian solution. Schwinger solution is always You write the generating functional in terms of some interaction term, the action part of the interaction term, where the field A is represented by a functional derivative with respect to J, and you apply it onto a free field generating functional. And in this case, I'm taking the simplest possible free field generating functional I can think of for a boson, where this propagator up in here is just the ordinary causal propagator, the Feynman propagator. It's not Feynman. I call it Feynman. There's a factor of 2i missing, but it's the Schuckelberg causal propagator, which just has delta mu nu. Okay? And dc is just the, I call it the Feynman propagator. It's just the simplest thing possible. So if you do this little teeny calculation, as if you were Schwinger, taking this operator on this, it's equivalent to Gaussian functional integration. You don't ever have to talk about functional integration. You can do this parametrically, a little bit of trivial algebra, and you come out with this statement. And you build yourself with this arbitrary choice of lambda, you build yourself your free photon propagator in an arbitrary gauge, which is given in this particular way. The one choice you cannot make is lambda equal 1 in QED. You could never make lambda equal 1 because that would be wrong, because you have equations of constraint and so forth in QED. Anyway, this other term, the trace log term, is just effectively it's a divergent phase factor, and you can absorb it in some other normalization. So I'm just going to forget this term. Whenever there'll be a normalization, and I'll just absorb it in that. But this is how you make gauge, how you can, in QED, a simple way of starting with, say, the simplest propagator imaginable, and pop yourself into any other relativistic gauge you want. Zeta equals 0 is Feynman gauge. Zeta equals 1 is the Landau gauge. Zeta equals minus 2 is the Yenny gauge, and so forth. This is QED. And now, so I say again, you can't use lambda equal 1 for QED. In QED, this is the form you get. This is Schwinger's solution, for example. You take these A's are replaced by D by DJ's, and they operate on the free photon propagator in a particular gauge. That's a zeta there. I mucked it up when I wrote the transparency. And so you specify the gauge at the outset. And you specify the gauge at the outset, and it's certainly not manifestly gauge invariant, but you can show the gauge invariance in QED in roundabout circuitous path. What you have to show, and what you can do, is that you show that the Z2 and the Z1, the wave function renormalization of the electron and the vertex renormalization factor, are exactly equal. They always cancel. The Z3 that goes into the charge renormalization is basically gauge invariant, and you show that by basically enforcing charge conservation whenever you calculate radiative directions. And then you have to show that all S-matrix elements that you can construct are going to be gauge invariant. It's a circuitous process. It certainly is not manifest. In QCD, I want to set up QCD the same way as in QED. The G equals zero theory in the two theories, the G equals zero limit of the same theory except for delta AB color, trivial color things. And so I'm going to do the same thing. There's a question here of legitimacy, which I don't want to talk about. If anybody wants to ask this later, we can talk about it. It's legitimate. But it takes a more of a discussion to go into it from a basic counting of variables point of view. So I'm going to do the same thing. Rather than invent the wheel, and since the G equals zero theories are the same, I'm going to set up the QCD theory with some other normalization constant, appropriate normalization constant, the quark sources, the log of the quark determinant, that interaction term, the cubic and quark terms, and the gauge for the gluons in a particular choice of relativistic gauge. I can even use an axial gauge. It doesn't have to be a relativistic, but it doesn't have to be the usual kind. And if you do it in this form, by the way, picking your gauge once at the very beginning you never have to worry about rebuff copies as you would have to in the other formulation. That's another point.
So why is that true?
Hmm?
So why don't you need to worry about rebuff copies?
Because I pick a gauge here. What I have to worry about is something else. Is it gauge invariant? Is the entire theory gauge invariant? And I have to wait and see if that's going to be true.
But if you pick a gauge, why you don't have to worry about rebuff copies?
Well, in the rebuff copies, you usually worry about in the integral over A. Okay? Sure. Or the integral over A. And you're going to see that we do the integral over A in a well-defined way. It's already determined by this thing. Give me a minute.
Okay.
So I want to comment now. I want to just point out to you that there's a very useful rearrangement that you can use. This is my invention, my humble invention, 30 or 40 years ago, because I Schwinger's formulation, where you have a horrible set of functions, functional differential operators operating on something simple, was always very complicated. But there's a simple rearrangement you can make. Suppose I have an arbitrarily complicated functional of d by dj operating on a simple form like this Gaussian form. I can rewrite it. That's supposed to be identically equal to, you bring this thing through, and then you take up the slack by writing this quantity times f of a, where a now, what is a in this formula? A is the integral over dc times j. I don't care what dc is. I don't care what this curly f is. It works. And it's an easy to prove. I won't do it. You can do it easily. So what I want to do then is to set up QCD, take this QCD, and write it in this fashion. I'll just bring it through. Here's the three gluon propagators in some gauge. This is the thing that contains all virtual photon fluctuations. That's your propagator. I'll call this quantity a linkage operator on the next slide, and then links one piece of the Green's function, one piece of the theory to another, non-perturbatively. And this piece is the piece on which it acts. This is just relativistic potential theory. If you know how to do potential theory, you can do that, and you can do that. And this is field theory. I mean, there's a nice distinction between field theory and potential theory, and you see it very nicely in this way, from a rearranged Schwinger solution.
Just so I understand the logic, this is a formal derivation at some level, right?
Schwinger gives a formal derivation.
So I can imagine doing background field gauge calculation, and I get this. And
you get that, yes.
You're making an ansatz, right?
No, you get that, perturbatively, dare I say.
Right.
Perturbatively. I should have said that. Okay. I just want to comment that top line there is just rewriting the whole thing for QCD. Again, I've rearranged and I've got this linkage operator here. I'll call e to the curly b of a, and it operates on all these things. The linkage operator is so easy to use. For example, and it's physical. All the Schwinger's manipulations, all of the confusion that many students have had, just disappears once you do things this way. For example, you take the linkage operator on two different functionals. And what is it? The result is that you operate the linkage operator on the first one as if the second one wasn't there. And you operate the linkage operator on the second one as if the first one wasn't there. And then you cross-link them with the exponential of this thing. One d by dE goes one way, the other goes the other way, and the factor of a half is missing. So use obvious generalization to multiple projects, to multiple products of these things. For example, in QED, suppose you want to write down all the different endpoint functions. This normalization factor, its inverse, is just this quantity. And this is just the vacuum to vacuum amplitude,
persistence? Vacuum persistence?
Persistence, that's the word I'm looking for. Thank you. The vacuum persistence. I couldn't remember the word persistence. The vacuum persistence amplitude, that the vacuum at t equals minus infinity is the same as the vacuum. That's fine. Suppose you want to look at the two-point function. I write it in configuration space in this fashion. If you make a quenched approximation, just because it's simple, because I don't want to worry about renormalization, okay? I know you worry about renormalization, and I do too.
I was going to worry about regularization, actually. I was wondering how your expression
regularized. I'll show you.
Okay.
So, that's the item model for you. I mean, that will happen. Regularization, let's talk about that later. Anyway, what is this SC prime, the completely regressed quantity? It's the bare one plus one bubble, well, not bubble, but one little, whatchamacallit, another one, another one, another one, and so forth. There's an infinite number of these things, and they're all given just by this linkage operator operating on this function. In Eichingel approximation, as it turns out, this function will just be the exponential of a linear form in A, for any abelian theory, exponential of a linear form in A, and this operation can be carried through exactly. All the quantum fluctuations are done exactly, then you may have to evaluate integrals, but they're ordinary integrals. You can write this in terms of functional integrals. That doesn't do you any good. But if you can evaluate, you find a form of this thing which can be expressed as the exponential of an ordinary integral over A, of a linear form in A, you can actually do this quantity. You can actually do it. For example, for PP scattering by the exchange of neutral vector mesons. What is it? I need a Green's function for particle for proton one, a Green's function for proton two. And I need the L. Let's do quenched approximation. Here I can say the scattering happens so quickly that we don't have to worry about the vacuum rearranging it or renormalization factors changing. So you just throw it away. And take this particular approximation without the L, and that means that the N is gone too. And this is exactly what you get. The first term corresponds to all the linkages across one. The second term corresponds to all the self-linkages across there. And the middle term is all the cross linkages. You want to do perturbation theory, the 25th power, be my guest. Expand the stuff out to 25th order. But it's stupid. It's not stupid, but you don't have to. There's a simple way of expressing the sum of all orders. And I think it's the most efficient way of writing down the sum of all relevant finite graphs. Renormalization things we can cover separately. And I don't want to talk about that because I've never get out of here. Okay.
Are you going to be using the quenched approximation later on?
See?
Are you going to be using the quenched approximation later on?
Or? Yes, I will. I'll use quenched approximation later on. Just to give you, but I'll tell you how to correct for it.
Is there a small parameter that I should be thinking of as well?
No. It's just for simplicity of presentation. No, I mean, I'm not saying quenching is irrelevant. If you have a scattering thing that happens quickly, you might say it is. That's what many people do say. And you can compare data. We've done that for years, comparing it to lower energy data. It works beautifully. For higher energy data, we don't know. So we don't know. But I can tell you how to go by calculating. But for simplicity of presentation, let's forget it. Just it's a complication, but not an essential one. And I'll show you where the changes will occur. So I say, when can you sum over all such graphs? I said this before in the abelian Eichingel limit, when the k's of the Fourier transform of all those a's are less than the p's, which are the Fourier transforms of the g's. And you have to be able to do certain things. But anyway, each Green's function will look like this. There'll be a factor of a p for a particle coming in from minus infinity and a particle going out to plus infinity. These are like proper times. With an extra, not quite the right dimensions, dimensions of time squared rather than time. These S's, they shrink at proper times. And as such, they're invariant. The S's are invariant quantities. If you typically, in Eichingel models, there's a place where you have to keep the distinction between an incoming P and an outgoing P prime, but it isn't here. And so for here, what you usually do is just say, what the hell? P minus P prime is momentum transfer. That has to be much less than the P's or P primes. So just take the same P and P prime here, so you can write a nice form like this. That's just the simplicity. But the functional operation on a linear function is trivial. It is immediate. This is what you do. Set A equal to zero. This is what you get. The F is this thing with a four-dimensional delta function in the middle. That's the Eichingel model.
So just a
comment.
If I'd been doing a background field gauge, I would have been thinking of comparing states and coherent states. Is that what you're, and then you're making the
I'm talking about, no, what I'm doing, if you want to keep a background field, you can. And you wouldn't set A equal to zero. I'm just talking about the field that is corresponding to the exchange of quanta in an ideal model of neutral quanta.
But I understand the small parameter you're keeping is you're trying to keep all the soft gluons. But then the thing that when you actually thing I'm missing is what you actually do. So the thing you keep is you keep what?
I'm keeping this.
Yeah, but what is that in terms of what you had before?
Well, that just comes out of the G. Each G, there's a G for particle one and a G for particle two. And each G will have such a factor. As long as you make the Eichel approximation and say that the Ks, of all the Fourier transforms in here, the Ks are going to be less than the input and output piece, the initial and final piece.
So you're doing all possible graphs, but you're choosing
yes.
a specific form for G, or you're throwing away some graphs? Mm-hmm. That's the thing I don't see.
But these aren't graphs. This is potential theory. This is just a Green's function.
Yeah, but I'm just trying to make contact between what you're doing and what everyone else does. And so if I had think of doing all kinds of graphs, the thing that you're doing that you're just finding the Eichel approximation is that you're not doing some graphs? Or you're
No. I haven't gotten to the graphs yet. I haven't gotten to the, but this point gets me to the graphs. Remember, there are integrals over this thing. There are other integrals that are coming over this thing.
But to keep me from being lost in the formulas, can you give me kind of a synopsis of what the bottom line is going to be for what it operationally means to do the approximation? Is it a special form for the Green's functions in the graph?
It's a special form for the Green's function. Okay. It's a special form for the Green's function. And it happens to be such that it carries the G here with it. And you want to look, if you look, for example, you look at 10th order Feynman graph of scattering. Take every single graph and look at 10th order when the in the restriction that the momenta exchange between the two particles is going to be less than the p's. In a relativistic sense, the k's are less than the p's or the p primes. That's it. And you sum up all those perturbation contributions, you'll get exactly what you get this way, expanding the 10th order.
And the things that you're neglecting are some.
The things that you're neglecting are the
powers of k.
Are the power, when k is on the order of p, and what you can do is actually set up a systematic correction to the Eichel approximation so that you carry all of those terms along with you. But what the Eichel approximation always gives you is tremendous damping, such that endpoint functions don't like to undergo a tremendous momentum transfer in any leg, or have tremendous energies, things change their direction because the quanta just damp out the entire process.
But if I want to think of this as a things, you've got something plus order, and qualitatively the order is k divided by some other momentum scale, but I should
is
think
it
of
k over p.
K over p.
Is the Lorentz invariant combinations of k and p?
Oh, the Lorentz invariant, absolutely.
So I just think all possible Lorentz invariant things involving k, and they're suppressed by some other notion of whatever Lorentz invariant.
You've already done it. You've already done any suppression when you write down this form of the Green's function. It's all completely relativistic. I'm saying k is less than p. What do you mean? Yeah. I mean k dot p in magnitude is going to be less than k squared in magnitude. Any k squared in magnitude. That's what I mean. When you do that and you say, what is the solution for your Green's function going to be, it'll be this. Your solution will have that factor in it. Okay? This part is 30 years old, you know, 40 years old or something.
You're describing a theorem as opposed to an ansatz. So you're saying that if I wanted to do a Taylor series of the Feynman rules, I found this.
You'll find that. You bet.
It's published in Facebook and Combo.
I've done three books. The first one was MIT Press in 72, and this is all in there,
that's
and other stuff. And I'll get to other things later, but that's old. I want to make the next comment. Not only can you do all the linkage operation, which means you're looking at summing all the fluctuations, when you have the exponential of the linear form, but if you have the exponential of the quadratic form, it also can be done. This is equivalent to Gaussian functional integration. It can be done by a functional integral. It can be done by algebraic means. And this is the result. This is, if I set A equal to zero at the end, remember, A is always the integral of dc over j, and when you set j equal to 0 at the end, that's the original source, you set the A equal to 0. What is this? This is some Green's function, some kernel k. It may not be an easy Green's function to solve, it may be a mess, and you may have to approximate it, but what you have done is sum over all the fluctuations. You've got all the radiative corrections in this statement. if this was the form of your entire process. For scattering, you just have a linear exponential linear form, but even if you had a quadratic form, this is what you'd get. Now, I want to go back to Schwingerian QCD in its original untransformed way, unrearranged way, and I'm about to give you the manifest gauge invariance part, which sends a chill down my spine, some sort of dope. Here is this quantity, the full thing that we wrote down, and I've taken that propagator in the form of a zeta of a specific gauge, and I've written it in this fashion again. The normalization factor isn't even here. This is the V0. This is the simplest thing we begin with. So this is the Schwinger solution in QCD, and this baby by itself is what we call the propagator together with this constant. And I don't want to use it, and I want to just keep it in this particular form. And the next thing I do, I want to remind you of an exact relation. I wrote it down at the beginning, the first or second transparency. L prime, the thing that has all the cubic and quartic interactions, L prime is just the difference of these two terms. And it can be rewritten as in this way. And I'm putting in here what the little f squared is. I put it over here. I did an integration by parts, one integration by parts, and wrote it in this form. And I want you to remember this form for L prime when I go to the next transparency, because I'm going to substitute this L prime back in here. That's all I'm going to do. It's a trivial sort of thing. Well, all I've done now is to substitute the L prime back in here, and this is what you get. You get a term with that Valenversian term. You get a 1 minus lambda sitting there, and you have the capital F squared term, and here's the DC of 0, just the original Feynman propagator. Now, you look at this thing, this is what we did a couple of months ago, and it suddenly hit us. In QED, there's no L prime. You cannot choose lambda equal to 1. But in QCD, you can choose lambda equal to 1. And if you choose lambda equal to 1, this term disappears. You're talking manifest gauge invariance, if you do that in QCD. That term disappears, and this is what you will get. I mean, it looks as completely innocent as the original one did. If you make a rearrangement, this is what you have. And I say here, you can't see it yet, but something extraordinary is happening. And I'll show you, as we go on to the next slide, what the extraordinary thing is that has happened. I've chosen lambda equal 1 in QCD. This is supposedly manifested gauge invariant. And by God, it is, as you'll see in a moment. Well, what do we do? What do we do with this thing? What do we do with the F squared? F squared has quartic A terms, cubic A, and quadratic A's in it. Excuse me. And so what we'll do is an old trick of Halpern's in the 70s. Marty Halpern at Berkeley wrote down as a functional integral over this quantity chi with some normalization. Obviously, you can always, it's like a Gaussian integral, and you can just you can use this to give you back an F squared. The point, and here's the definition of the Gaussian of the functional integral in all its glory. Why do you do this? Because the f mu nu is quadratic in A. And f mu nu, f is quadratic in A. And as far as we're concerned, the identical amplitudes you can then obtain completely non-perturbatively. But it's even better than that. So what I want to do in this example is consider quark scattering or quark anti-quark scattering at high energies, use an identical model. You expect always a scattering amplitude. If you had quarks, which were just real particles, you'd expect a scattering amplitude that looks like this. This Q is the momentum transfer, and so forth. And this chi is not to be confused with this chi. This is just the ordinary identical function that depends upon total center of mass energies and the impact parameter. So I want to use. What I'm going to do is take functional derivatives with respect to eta and eta bar once, brings down the G for one quark. Do it again, brings down another G. I'm going to throw the L away just for simplicity of presentation. And in these Gs, I'm going to say we have to make an Eichler model. Now there's another question, because the Eichler model I've talked about so far is an abelian situation. What do you do for a non-abelian situation? This we did in the last decade. We figured out how to do this. I'll show you that in the next slide. And then you see what happens. In going from the abelian to the non-abelian situation, the quantity e to the ik, the Eichler function, suddenly has these functional integrals over alpha 1, alpha 2, omega 1, omega 2, and some function up here, and then ordered exponentials along here. That's lambda 1 divided into alpha 1, lambda 2 divided into alpha 2. Lambda 1 is the Gell-Mann matrix for particle 1, lambda 2 is the Gell-Mann matrix for particle 2. The quantity R is all the linear terms in A that will come out. We'll see where they come from. The quantity K plus delta K, well, K is the AA term, the quadratic term that came from the chi term. This just came from the F dot chi that we had on the other slide. And the delta K, I call it, is the baby that came from the minus del square. So the two of them sit there like that. The quantity R came from is e to the IR. One of them is from the Eichler from one piece, the Eichler from another piece. And then there was in the F dot A, there was a linear term in A, multiplying a chi, and that got rearranged, lost a factor of two, and is sitting here like that. So we got all the A dependence that we had before. The alpha and the omega arise when you extract the A dependence from each Green's function from under its ordered exponential. This is what you find when you actually write down representations for the Green's function. I have to tell you, these representations go by the name of Fradkin representations, and the Schwinger is the most important name in the beginning of this. Fradkin is the second most important name. I'll tell you about Fradkin at the very end, and it was urging you to look at his representation. What happens is that in a perfectly exact representation, you'll find an ordered exponential for a non-abelian problem rather than an ordinary exponential for an abelian problem. It's ordered because you have lambdas up here as well. And what this means is when you expand this thing out, expand the exponential out, you order them such that the largest value of S always stands to the left. That's an ordered exponential. Occur in different ways in different problems. What do? You want to take the A's out of this thing. Well, you do it by writing a functional integral in S space. Here's alpha 1 of, here's alpha of S. And here's the delta functional. It's a product of delta functions at every single S value. You divide the S region up into zillions of little regions. And this is the delta functional. And obviously, this integral over every one of them is just going to pop, replace this alpha by the P dot A. So this is a true statement. How do you write a delta functional? You write a Fourier delta functional in terms of the omegas. And you do it in this fashion. And what you achieve by doing this is to have the A dependence sitting out unordered. Later on, you have to worry about the ordering of this quantity. That's certainly true. You have to worry about it. But what we'll see is that in this particular model, you don't even have to worry about it. It will be just simplified tremendously. Now, I want to focus attention on the linkage operator, which can be done exactly. I'm taking the linkage operator on A's. Here it is. Along on this quantity, and I set the A equal to zero. This is Gaussian functional integration.
Does it still have the same form of support?
Does it still have these
functional, spare functional derivatives for something between the linkage operator? So before it was D by E to the D by DA something.
Yeah, that's up here. That's the DA. That's there in here.
That's not a manifestly gauge invariant thing, D by DA something, D by DA. So
it's gauge, it has a gauge term in it. It still has a gauge term in it. It had D zero in it, the Feynman gauge. But wait. Wait, I mean, you haven't seen the what happens.
Well, but I know that gauge transforms if you've got manifest gauge invariance.
I'm saying you'll see. Wait, just give me another 3 seconds. 30 seconds. 30 seconds is all it is. You take this linkage operator, this has a D0 in it, choice of final gauge. And this is what you get. Okay? This is the D0, and there's a D0, and here's a K. The two R's are on each side of it. That's just what we had before. And you have this particular factor. I want to say before I do anything else, this contains all the cubic and quartic interactions. This contains everything. There's integrals over chi that have to be done and all of that. But this contains it all. Now I want to observe, this is my punchline if you wish, observe that this delta K is this operator. This delta K operating on DC0 gives you a 1. And this particular 1 will cancel the 1 of this denominator. Where is the denominator here? The delta K DC term cancels that 1. And what you're left with in the denominator is just this particular thing in the denominator. Now I go to the next page. Here it is again. Here's the R, DC, here's the full denominator, minus 1, and the R. And I said that the 1 is going to cancel out, and this is what you have left. But this quantity, I can write as this. And look what happens. The DC's canceled. They're gone. They're gone. There's no gauge dependence left. The choice lambda equal 1 forces the DC's to disappear. This is almost exactly what a ghost particle does. What happens when you have ghosts? The people who did these things before always just did a functional integral, but there was no understanding of what is really going on here. I've used this argument for the Feynman propagator D0. I set it up like that because it was the simplest thing, but you don't have to do that. I can set this argument up for any arbitrary gauge I want, and exactly the same thing will happen. Once you choose lambda equal 1, all the propagators cancel out, and what you're left with is this.
When you put in the ghosts, that's exactly what happens in the measure.
That's right.
Put them in, it all cancels out.
What I'm saying is, I'm not using ghosts. If you want, I still have e to the I over 2j, dc, j. It's equivalent to it. But it was never discussed in this way. And when we saw this, we just jumped up and down. And then we jumped up and down again when we saw in this paper by Reinhardt and Tomini a month ago, we saw that they get exactly this sort of denominator when they do a field strength analysis non-perturbatively. I mean, I believe that we were right, but seeing somebody else get the same thing makes you feel very happy because you see that this is not just figment of our imagination. This is really the case. We have all powers of G in here, and the answer is gauge invariant. I call it gauge invariant with a vengeance. All the gauge terms cancel away. You can pick any gauge you wish to begin this thing rather than the Feynman gauge that I pick, and you get the same effect.
Could I just ask, is there a distinction here between gauge independence at the end of the calculation and manifest gauge invariance? Because
no, that's right. What we have is gauge independence. If you look at the Reinhardt paper, for example, it's a very good question. If you look at the Reinhardt paper, they still can have a choice of gauge. What they have done is to fiddle around and they change the choice of gauge is put on the Fs and then is transferred from the Fs to the chi field. There's a G of chi. And they still have that there in their formalism, if you want to pick a particular gauge in QCD. Now, how do you go from their answer to our answer, which doesn't have any such thing? You say, what is a gauge? Why do you use a gauge in the first place? You choose a gauge, a particular gauge, to make a calculation easy. If you're doing infrared calculations in QED, you choose the Yagi gauge, zeta equal minus 2. If you're doing ultraviolet calculations, you always choose the Landau gauge. It makes your calculation easy.
Let me finish
my spiel, okay? If the thing is gauge invariant, it doesn't make any difference what gauge you choose. So what we could do is average over two different gauges, and in principle, you get the same answer.
Sure, but let me just make one point there. So suppose you had a manifestly gauge invariant operator. If you were Or rather, let's suppose you had a really manifest gauge of variable formalism, which you never fixed the gauge. If you wrote down a correlation function of anything which isn't manifest gauge invariant itself, such as the things for which we usually compute scattering energies for, you'd find zero. So there's a difference between a formalism which is manifest gauge invariant from the start, and a formalism which has gauge independence.
Here you don't find zero.
So that's the thing. So I wouldn't say that this is manifest gauge invariant in that sense. I think
let me finish my argument that I was about to say. If you take the Reinhardt paper, where you always have this choice of gauge, and average over 16 different gauges, divide by 16, you're going to get the same answer.
Sure.
It doesn't make any difference. So why not assume the gauge choice can be made continuously?
No, sure.
And then you integrate over all the gauge choices, you have this infinite volume factor of the gauge space, it goes into a normalization constant, and that's just the answer we get.
Sure, but I mean, you could formulate the whole thing, for example, on a lattice or even in the continuum. Without gauge fixing ever, so I think there is a qualitative difference between those two things.
Then the thing you're talking more about that I don't know. I've never done an Elias and so forth. I just know that if you do it this way, you obviously have something that's independent of gauge, and it's equivalent to what these other guys did when you average over all possible gauges. And so,
I just think there is,
gives you the right physics. The right physics is going to come out of here.
Gauge independence and manifest gauge invariance. That's
okay. It's gauge independent. Yeah. And because we chose lambda equal to 1, that's how we got it. That's manifest gauge invariance.
So I disagree with that statement.
Okay, well, I don't. I mean, we can argue later. Anyway, what you get is something which you can calculate with, because what happens now is that this K, which involves an F, this K is F dot, the FABC times the chi C times mu nu. And you have to take its inverse. But this is a local. This is a local quantity. There's no propagator in there that goes the way that takes you from one point to another. It's a local quantity. And this makes a tremendous simplification of everything that follows. Please.
I'm going to miss the point because I didn't have the hallelujah moment when I saw our famous R, but I think I did understand what you were saying. Is the upshot that you've got, what's nice about your answer is that it's independent of the gauge parameter? Is that what you're saying? Yeah. That's the bottom line.
Completely independent of, you pick a gauge, it'll cancel out. Any gauge you wish, it'll cancel away.
So it's gauge independent.
It's gauge independent. I call it gauge invariant. You may not agree, but I call it gauge invariant. I mean, I don't see any gauge.
You know, it's the manifest gauge invariance that I disagree with.
Okay, well, I'm sorry.
Manifest is in the eye.
Manifestly, it's manifestly independent of gauge.
So manifest is in the eye of the beholder.
It's just like the.
Because I mean, you can really start where you don't fix gauge at all from the beginning, and then you have exact invariance under the full gauge transformations rather than just residual BRSP invariant, so there is a difference.
Yeah.
Well, it would be nice to see. Show me that later. Show me how the formalism looks. I don't know that formalism.
Another way of doing it is to take the maximum value part of fixed gauge, put in the ghost, just cancel out the air, and then you can have BRS invariant. And once you have the BRS invariant, it's manifest gauge invariant. I can actually do the calculation.
I wouldn't call that, no.
Anyway, I only have a 3 minutes more, and I want to just get to the punchline. This is my first punchline. The second punchline is that all the integrals that we've spoken about become, all the functional integrals that we've spoken about, the one over chi, the ones over alpha, the ones over omega, are reduced down to ordinary integrals. I don't have time, I mean, I can show you these things very, very quickly, but I don't have time to display it. Anyway, can I take a few minutes more? I mean, if somebody comes in.
We haven't turned up yet.
They haven't turned up yet, all right. Go away.
We'll kick them out.
I'm going to look at the most significant. It turns out, in fact, that the easy thing to calculate is the large G limit. It's easier than calculating the small G situation. So I'm just going to look for simplicity of presentation. I'm going to assume G is very large. And when I assume G is very large, I'm also only going to look at the Q1 dot Q2 piece. I don't care about the self-energies of a given quark. That's a different matter. I want to just look at the interactions between them. Okay? I can handle the self-energy separately, but I don't want to do that. So if you do that, this is what you'll find. This thing simplifies down so much, so completely, it's just extraordinary. Each of these Qs is proportional to a delta function with a different value of S and a different value of P. You don't have an action at a distance propagator anymore. You have local quantities. That means that the functional integral over Halperin's variable, the omega variable in that chi of omega, that omega variable is restricted to one particular point. It's a four-dimensional space-time point. That means that the entire functional integral of chi is evaluated at one particular point. All the other values of chi go into a normalization factor, irrelevant.
The point in momentum space? Or
in configuration space. Configuration space. One of the great things about field theory is that you don't have to use momentum space. I gave a talk here last October called Anapaque, in which I pointed out that if you calculate the momentum space, you make miseries for yourself. Calculate the configuration space, cancellations happen. Anyway, the entire integral is evaluated, I call it a fixed point. It's not a real fixed point that you would talk about, but it's one special point called omega zero. The S12 variables are also fixed, very close to zero. And so not only is the chi integral made into an ordinary integral, but the alpha 1 and the alpha 2, the omega 1 and the omega 2 also go out with their normalization factors, disappear, and they are only, I have to skip all this. I want to show you the final cut to the chase. Here's the chase. What remains of this exponent is something that looks like this. This phi of b will come from a delta function of b. Looks like a delta function of b, impact parameter, difference of two coordinates of the two ports, the horizontal, the transverse difference. What the devil does this mean? I said it's local, but of course at this point you have to understand you're talking about quarks. You can't measure anything for quarks. Quarks are bound in hadrons. And even if they're binding and when they scatter, they may come out of the hadrons temporarily. They have a transverse distribution. If you take that transverse distribution into account, because you're talking about quarks and not particles, the Eigenlohr model has to be corrected for quarks. What happens is that you have to cut off this k dependence, and you cut it off. The typical thing, the way you cut it off, make a long song and dance much quicker, is at some value of m, which is on the order of the energy. I've got to stop talking. Finally, I'll just say one more thing. This is the real punchline of the entire thing. You make a scattering amplitude, and the scattering amplitude will have impact parameter dependence. This is your function. The impact parameter, it depends upon impact parameter. And there's always a g times a phi. G is large, phi is, that's like one. Phi can be very small or on the order of one. What happens as a function of impact parameter when the impact parameter is large? Suppose I have a quark scattering with an anti-quark. I want to look at binding. I'm cutting to the chase here. And suppose they're at large B, not obviously large, but moderately large B. Then even though I've taken G as large, that phi is going to go to zero. And this piece has all the, this piece that's sitting in there will have all the, will connect onto the lambda 1 and the lambda 2 to the color coordinates. And the color coordinates will just disappear from the problem, from the internal part of the problem. You'll get effectively coherent scattering. You have zillions of colored gluons going by, but there's so many of them that effectively the color coordinates of the scattering quarks don't change. If for a quark and an anti-quark, they will be attracting each other. But the moment they get small, that the impact parameter gets smaller, what happens is that you start getting fluctuations of the color coordinates. They begin to appear. This quantity becomes on the order of one again, and G is large. And so you start getting color fluctuations. The fluctuations kill the coherence. And that means that it's like an effective asymptotic freedom. The effective coupling goes down, because you're getting color fluctuations. And so what happens is they start to move apart. They move apart, the B gets large again, and they'll be attracted to each other. This is quark, anti-quark binding. This is like an MIT bag model. When you get too close to each other, the quark and an anti-quark get too close, there's no force, or a small force of attraction. When they move apart from each other, then you have an attraction. It's like if you convert these ideas to the vertex function, the thing that's conjugate to B, the variable conjugate to B is momentum transfer. And so you, it says for large momentum transfer, for large Qs, for a vertex function, it's going to get small. You're going to have large Q means small b, color fluctuations, and you get no coupling. The coupling effectively is, gets very small in magnitude. But for larger impact parameters, smaller Q, you get an attraction. That's like asymptotic freedom, only it has, it's not just asymptotic freedom perturbatively of a couple of graphs, it's asymptotic freedom summing over all virtual graphs. This is the way to do QCD, in my opinion, where you can actually connect with experiments and you can see what's happening. Finally, people are waiting outside. I've got to stop. People are waiting outside, but one more word. If you want to do, I mean, this is just my 40, 50 years experience in this field, 40 years experience. I said before that the second most important name is Fradkin. This is Efimov Fradkin, the Russian, died about 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. In the mid-50s, he invented, right after Schrödinger's papers with their formal functional solutions, Fradkin wrote a representation, what I call the Fradkin representation, which tells you how to explicitly write these Green's functions so you can try and use Schrödinger's formal representation. For example, Schrödinger, being a very smart man, was able to solve a couple of problems automatically in field theory because he was very, very smart. He, in certain limits, he could solve the entire problem, like particle production from a strong constant electric field. You look at Fradkin's representation and you say to yourself, of course, that's when the Schrödinger solutions are possible. Immediately, they will correspond just to doing Gaussian integrations over Fradkin's variables. But when you look at Fradkin, you find out what else you have to do and what the real structure is. So for anybody who is interested in actually doing QCD from first principles, I would say begin with Schrödinger and then go to Fradkin right away. The only place I've ever seen Fradkin's representation written, aside from his papers, which hard to get to, well, I'm almost done. I am done. The only place I've ever seen it written is in my second book. It's the functional methods and ideal models, published in France. Impossible to get. And so, if anybody ever wants a copy, get a copy and reproduce it. That's what I do all the time. I give it to graduate students.
For the internet.
I mean, I wouldn't worry about the legalities of it. But in that book, you could find the Fradkin representations done for QED, done for QCD. And I think that's the way to go. Anyway, that's what this is. And it comes out of that. And this is, if it isn't manifest gauge invariance, by God, it's the next step to it. Okay, thank you.
This is a